Joshua P. Warren back with us as we call in, talk to him about hauntings and spirit travel, and then we'll take your calls later on Coast to Coast AM. Joshua P. Warren back with us. Josh, of course, is the internationally recognized expert on the mysterious, the paranormal, and the unknown. And, of course, he spends a lot of his time in Puerto Rico and Asheville, North Carolina. His website, joshuapwarren.com, is visited by zillions of people. And here he is back on Coast to Coast, one of our regular friends, Joshua P. Warren. Hey, Josh, where are you now?
Hey, George, I am still here in Asheville, North Carolina, heart of the scenic Blue Ridge Mountains. And I'll be here, probably until just after the first of the year. I'm actually doing some renovations right now on the Asheville Mystery Museum.
Aha!
And then I'll be heading back to Puerto Rico to bring you some more research from the Bermuda Triangle.
Excellent. Now, have you been in Asheville since our August event?
Yes, I have. I've made a few small trips here and there, but I had a lot of catching up to do here. And in fact, George, I have a really interesting update for you. Since your trip here to do your live stage show in August.
Okay.
Now, of course, for listeners who may not know, when you came here to do the show, it was obviously a huge hit, packed house. And one of the sort of special things that I decided to add to the mix was a piece of UFO debris from the Roswell area that we put on display outside the theater.
With security guards.
Absolutely, yes. There was a lot of security because we actually decided that we were going to allow all of the attendees to line up and walk by and get at least a few seconds to actually touch the debris.
Exactly. And what you didn't need was somebody walking by and taking the debris.
Yeah, that's right, because it's usually, you know, under a case. I mean, it's under lock and key, so this was a risky move. But fortunately, Coast fans are great people, and we did not have any problems. But, you know, there was one lady, her name was Kat, and she's actually a great artist, it turns out. She told me she even gave you a T-shirt.
Yeah, I did get a T-shirt from someone.
Okay, well, this was this lady. She got in line, and she made it to our table where we were signing, and she was really excited, and she said that when she touched this UFO debris, that it actually stood up in her hand. Now, let me pause by saying one of the things that's so interesting about this debris is that when you take this debris and you put it in an electrostatic field, it will stand up on end and begin to spin around wildly. And I discovered this shortly after I obtained this. In fact, if you have not seen the video footage of this, I shot a video in my kitchen right after I first got this debris years ago, where my friends and I are standing around, and yes, I'm one of the few people who probably has an electrostatic generator in my kitchen. and I shot this video where we put the debris into this little metal pie pan on top of the generator, and you see it just stand up. I mean, and this is just a little piece of, like, a sliver of metal. It stands up on its end. It just goes spinning around incredibly stably and would continue to do so until we plucked it out of there. I've got that video posted on my website, joshuapwarren.com. And so when she said that she put this debris in her hand, that it stood up or curled up, I was especially intrigued. So she made a trip back to Asheville just so that I could study her. And at one point, we sat down in a restaurant, and we got some really weird looks in our direction.
I bet you would.
And I took out the debris, and I put it in her hand. And oddly enough, she has these hard little lumps in her hand that she thinks may be some kind of objects, right, that she can't explain.
Implants?
Well, something like that is a good possibility. She has been obsessed with aliens her whole life. She, as an artist, is always drawing aliens. And so I put the debris in her hand, and we never saw it stand up, even though she does have a picture, which is underneath the video on my website, of this thing standing up in her hand. But here is one of the things that really surprised me. I started measuring her hand with a variety of meters, and I was getting an enormous amount of radioactivity around her hand. I had a Geiger counter that was picking up X-rays, alpha, beta, gamma. And it was not consistent, but there were times we get these incredible bursts around her hand. And we had a lot of other people there we were using as controls. and that didn't happen with anybody else. And so I was quite intrigued by that, and we are going to continue our research, but I just wanted to let you know that because of your event here in Asheville and bringing the UFO debris out there, I met this lady who might help us hold some key to how this technology interacts with humans, especially humans who may have implants.
Sounds good. I thought you were going to offer me a recording contract or something like that.
I'm sorry, George. I'll save that for Christmas. I'll call you Christmas Eve and tell you about that good news.
We did have fun in Asheville, though, Josh.
Everybody loved it so much, and it's too bad that you weren't able to stay here even longer, but I can't believe that you just pop into town after such a long flight, do those things, and then fly out without any sleep. You're an amazing guy.
I keep going.
You're running for office.
I'm a ghost.
Well,
I'm a traveling ghost.
That's right. You know, that's one of the things that I wanted to tell you about tonight. I've been working on this case that has become so unusual. It's almost become sort of a textbook case when it comes to ghostly phenomena. And this is something I think all the listeners will especially appreciate because it gives a very realistic viewpoint of how I think that some of these spirits are able to travel and interact with you. Now, let me start by saying most people think of a haunted place as these locations we generally call imprints or residuals, a place where something is replayed over and over.
Okay.
For example, at coasttocoastam.com, Lex put up a photograph I sent him of this old house in Western North Carolina. In fact, it's the oldest house in Western North Carolina. It's in Transylvania County. It's called the Allison Dever House.
What a great name for a county, too.
Yeah, it works, doesn't it? And it was built in 1815, so this is over 200 years old. And in 1865, there was a man shot and killed on the porch there. It was due to a Civil War-related incident. His son was a captain in the Confederacy, and his son was tasked with going out and capturing guys who were deserters, people who had gone AWOL, and bringing them back. And he was not a very popular guy. He made a lot of enemies. And then there were some soldiers and some family members, I guess, who showed up to kill him. And he wasn't there, but his father came out on the porch, and they thought his father was him, and they killed his father there on the porch, and they dragged him inside, and he bled to death. And to this day, people keep seeing this blood stain that will appear and then disappear. They can hear moaning around that room. They hear furniture being dragged around in that room. And the activity always seems to center around that incident and things related to how we can imagine that incident was somehow burned or recorded into the environment. That's one type of phenomenon that is, I think, the most prominent type. Now, what we're going to talk about tonight is a very different type of phenomenon, and you'll see what makes it so different.
Right.
In that story I just gave you, it was obvious what was happening there. We had an extreme historic incident. But what happens when you go to a place that's very active, and there is no obvious explanation historically for what's going on?
Which happens.
It happens all the time, and it leaves people in a very perplexed state of mind. So I was contacted in, late September by a good friend of mine, Mr. Mobius. Some of your listeners know him, and he's always got his feelers out there. And, you know, people frequently contact me, George, and they invite me to go and investigate private residences. And I often will do that, but in many cases I'm not able to talk about what I find there because most people want to keep their activity private. They don't want their house to become a circus. And so I'm always very happy when I come across a case that I can talk about publicly, and this is one of them. There is a property in West Asheville which was being renovated at the time. Now, of course, you probably hear all the time that a renovation sometimes triggers paranormal phenomena. Now, this particular property for many, many years, going back to about 1960, was an old barbecue restaurant that went out of business and sat there abandoned for years and has just recently been renovated into a new German and European-inspired restaurant called the Byrish House and Pub, and that's spelled B-Y-R-I-S-H. And when they started renovating this property to turn it into this new German and European restaurant, the employees started getting scared to death because objects started flying around in the kitchen area. They kept seeing the figure of a man in a dark suit sitting in a booth near the ladies' room. There were people walking into cold spots that would make their hair stand on end. Just a plethora of things that were occurring, and they didn't know why. So I went over there, and I started interviewing the employees, and I started taking measurements, and sure enough, I found all kinds of anomalous energy fields that I couldn't explain. And I thought, well, surely something dramatic must have happened here. So I got in touch with my good friend Vance Pollock, who is the best historian I know. I call him a forensic historian because he's able to get down to the nitty-gritty and find the most obscure little details about things related to a property's history. And Vance went to work, and he went through all the files, and he said, you know, Josh, he says, it's weird. He said, this piece of property, it for many, many years was just a wooded property on the edge of a farm. There was nothing dramatic that happened here I can find. He said, you know, the guy who opened it as the barbecue restaurant was named Gus Cools, and Gus lived his whole life and working there, and when he died, his family took it over, and they ran it until it went out of business, and we just couldn't find anything, you know, amazing that occurred there. And he said, however, he said, I did find something that's interesting. He said, now, Gus Cools had a colleague in the restaurant business. And this is another man in Asheville whose name was also Gus. His name was Gus Adler. Now, Gus Adler has a much more interesting story. See, Gus Adler was a German Jew, and that's very important to point out. He came over here to Asheville in the 1930s. And he opened up Asheville's first German restaurant in a big old building on the side of a mountain that overlooks Asheville. The name of the building, we now call it the Sky Club. But at that time, he opened this restaurant there called the Heidelberg. And it did well for a while. But then as the United States started to get closer and closer and heading toward World War II, being involved with anything German was not very popular.
That was not good. That's right. Even though he was Jewish.
Exactly. See, people back then, they didn't know how to make that nuanced distinction. This guy, Gus Adler, he had no affinity for the Nazis whatsoever. But people started to spread rumors about his business. They started to vandalize his business. And basically, it ran him out of business. It was a very unfortunate scenario. He was never able to get properly back on his feet. He became a severe alcoholic. And one night, he went to his little cottage, which was near the building.
Oh, boy.
There.
I can see what's coming now.
Yeah. He'd been drinking too much. He got in bed with a cigarette.
Oh.
Yeah. And when he woke up, his mattress was on fire. He'd already breathed in so much smoke that he could barely make his way to the bathroom where he thought he could get, we presume, better ventilation. He flopped over on his hands and knees. He crawled toward the bathroom. He never made it. And so he was found there dead, lying on the floor, trying to crawl for air.
Oh, jeez. Was he burned too, or just the air problem?
You know, he actually did not get burned, amazingly enough. It was just the smoke inhalation that killed him.
Yeah, and the fibers in the mattress and all that in those days.
Yeah, that's right. So now this guy, of course, had a very tragic life and an unfortunate life. And so I go back to the restaurant, and I start talking to employees more about what they're experiencing and showing them pictures of Gus Adler. And they're saying, yeah, that's the guy, that's the guy. And it turns out that a lot of the activity started picking up when they added the fire pits onto the property out back. They have a big, nice patio back there. And it became clear and clear that there was a good chance that, in fact, this man, Gus Adler, who maybe had never even ever visited that property, was still coming there now because he opened up Asheville's first German restaurant, which unfortunately failed due to circumstances outside his control. So maybe he's now interested in this new German restaurant in Asheville now that times have changed, right? So we started to investigate this further to see, okay, how can we tell whether or not this might actually be Gus Adler, his spirit traveling through space and time, literally haunting a location that he was presumably not even at when he was alive.
That's interesting.
So we started doing investigation, and this was getting close to Halloween, and we did something, George, that you're not going to like.
Uh-oh, what'd you do?
We decided to break out a Ouija board.
No!
Yeah. And
With fire there.
Well, yeah, this one was especially playing with fire because we got a big group of people together. Now, this was getting close to Halloween time. And I got together with investigator Shelley Wright, who owns a magic shop in Asheville, and she brought a nice 3D glass Ouija board from her shop.
How could you say a Ouija board is nice, regardless of what it looks like?
This was it was a well-made one, let's put it that way. And we got together in this room off to the side of the restaurant there, like a meeting room. And we lowered the lights. We had some candles. We had a variety of different little devices mm-hmm. there that would maybe help us detect anything. And by the way, seances, I mean, that's not something that I usually specialize in. I mean, I do investigations. It's uncommon for me to lead a seance. But under these particular circumstances, again, close to Halloween, I thought maybe we'll give it a shot. Let's just see what happens.
So you're doing a seance with a Ouija board.
Yeah, that's right. So I was sitting there. Now, we had a big table with people all around it. We had various members of the media there to document what was happening objectively. The Ouija board is sitting between me and Shelley Wright. And we decided to be the two people to operate the planchette. Now, I also want to pause here to say that I have always been particularly doubtful and skeptical when it comes to Ouija boards. And one of the reasons is, in the past, I have done experiments with people who are very good at using a Ouija board, and they will sit down and they'll start getting all kinds of words and communications, and then you say, now let's change the scenario a little bit, and you blindfold them. And now all of a sudden, they start getting gibberish. So I've always thought that, okay, a Ouija board can indeed be a great tool in order to help you maybe tap into some kind of subconscious psychic ability. But I never really felt like the Ouija board itself was some kind of a tool that could open a portal or a doorway or become possessed necessarily and move around on its own. I've always been doubtful about that, and so it's important to know this as I start to tell you what happened when we did our session.
This backfired on you, didn't it?
Well, now, to make matters worse, George, and I know you're gonna kill me for saying this, all right? I literally said out loud before we began this, I said, look, we are granting permission for anything to come through here.
Anything?
Yes. I know.
You did everything that you said you would never do.
Well, I guess I didn't feel like there was anything evil or demonic. I just felt like there was some kind of, you know, I needed to know more about what this presence was.
I can only imagine what happened when you get to it, because I can feel it now.
Yeah, and by the way, I do not recommend that anybody else do that.
Ah, see?
Yeah. And because you don't know what's going to happen when you do it. And in fact, I listened to the show last night, and your guest was talking about, you know, Ouija boards as well, and how you know, some people are like me. They want to experiment. They like taking risks. So be it. But when it comes to my particular case, I was willing to do the experiments, but I don't think other people who are just curious should do this sort of stuff.
Josh, we're going to come back and hear more about this story, but I'm guessing something bad happened. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Joshua P. Warren. So Josh, you're in the seance, you've got the Ouija board, you're trying to look for Gus. What happens?
You sound so optimistic, George.
Uh-huh.
Well, okay, now this was last October, just to catch everybody up. So imagine, here it is, a spooky, crisp, late October night in the mountains of Western North Carolina. Here we are at this haunted restaurant, the Byrish House and Pub. We're off there in a back room, surrounded by people. There are candles burning. I'm sitting there with my fingers on the planchette of the Ouija board, Investigator Shelley Wright is next to me. And Shelley, by the way, is a graduate of my paranormal classes. I do teach classes from time to time. In fact, I'm going to do some online classes this winter, if any of your listeners are interested. I've never done that before. And so I was, I'm sitting there, and the planchette begins to move. It starts to slide. Now, mind you, I opened this up wide, and I said, we'd like to communicate with Gus, or maybe anybody else who might want to, you know, give us a message.
Mm-hmm.
So it slides first to O, then it switches directions, and it slides over to H, and then it stops. And we sit there, and we wait, we wait, we wait. Nothing else happens. O-H. I'm thinking, well, that is meaningless. Is it O? You know, what is it? And so I look up to the small group around, and I said, O-H. And I look over to the corner, and here's Vance, the historian. I said, Vance, does O-H mean anything to you? And Vance visibly shuddered, and he said, Josh, the man who built Gus Adler's restaurant, the Sky Club, was a man named O.C. Hamilton.
Huh.
And at that point, the whole room kind of gets goosebumps. And so Vance goes, that is so obscure. He goes, that's such an obscure bit of history that he says, I've never even brought that up to you or anybody
right.
else.
Not many people would know that.
No. And so we go back to the Ouija board, and we can't get any more action out of the Ouija board. Nothing.
Whose hands are on the planchette?
Mine and Shelley Wright's.
Okay.
And so at that point, we pretty much resolved the evening. We brought everything to a close, and we thought, well, that was fascinating because it seems like we at least got some initials here that may have a direct relationship to this individual and his restaurant. But Vance said, you know, he goes, this guy, O.C. Hamilton, has always been a mystery to me. He said, I'm very good at finding the paper trail in a person's life. And every time I've tried to figure out who O.C. Hamilton was, the paper trail ends so abruptly, it's almost like this guy had a double life or something. And so Vance, of course, became very obsessed with finding out more about O.C. Hamilton. Within 24 hours, Vance emailed me and said, Josh, check this out. I found the grave of O.C. Hamilton. And he sent me a link to a picture of a gravestone. And he says, trust me, this is not a mistake. So I click the link, and a stone comes up that says John J. Carroll. And I said, well, are you telling me that O.C. Hamilton was actually a man named John J. Carroll? And he says, yes. Well, here's who John J. Carroll was. John J. Carroll was a very well-known and well-respected Catholic priest in Chicago. And he ended up falling in love with a woman named Kate Bailey.
While he was a priest?
While he was a priest. And when she became pregnant, he took her down to Asheville, North Carolina, and he assumed this phony name of O.C. Hamilton, and he told everybody he was a philanthropist and a developer, and for some reason he had a heck of a lot of money, and he built this nice building for her and put her up there and was very generous in the community and lived out the rest of his life as a priest in Chicago and as this man named O.C. Hamilton in Asheville. And that was never revealed in his entire life. And now I'm thinking, well, this is getting even weirder and juicier. And I was thinking, maybe this guy, O.C. Hamilton, i.e. John J. Carroll, maybe he feels very guilty about what he did in life being so deceptive, and, you know, he's trying to come clean here. He's trying to give us some kind of a message. As if that weren't enough, George. Now listen to this. After all this, I go have a meeting with one of the owners of the restaurant, a guy who likes to remain private. We'll call him Bob. So Bob said, well, what's going on here? What did you find out? And so I told Bob this whole story that I have told you and the listeners up to this point. And when I said O.C. Hamilton was actually a man named He literally lit up and said the name John J. Carroll at the same time it came out of my mouth. And I'm like, what? How could you possibly know? Like, nobody knows this. This is not recorded in any mainstream history. How could you know that John J. Carroll was this priest living this double life who built this restaurant in Asheville? And he said, well, he said, when I was younger, he said, I lived for many years in Chicago.
Aha. He knew the story. Was it a big scandal?
Nobody knew anything about it. To this day, nobody.
Not even up in Chicago?
No, even in Chicago, nobody knows about this. People in Chicago are learning this right now, listening to Coast AM. And so, but he knew this, and Bob said that when he was growing up in Chicago, that he was always looking for places, like properties to develop into restaurants and bars. And at one point, Al Capone's old hideout came up for sale. And he thought Al Capone's old hideout would make a great speakeasy, of course. And he got involved and tried to bid on this and buy it. And there were all these parties that were interested in getting it. And he got to know all these people. And he found out in this process that Al Capone's personal priest, who actually christened his children,
was this guy.
Was one John J. Carroll. I.e. O.C. Hamilton, this figure that apparently came through at our seance.
So you think it was that figure who came through, or Gus was telling you about him?
I'm thinking, George, that basically what happened here is Gus Adler had traveled from his property to be there at this new property, but he's more the benevolent type. When we opened up the seance wide open for anybody to come through, I think this very troubled figure associated with Gus Adler took that opportunity to come through, and this was O.C. Hamilton, i.e. John J. Carroll. Now, imagine if this guy was a Catholic priest, then that means that he had to believe in purgatory. And whether or not anyone listening to this program believes in purgatory, if he believed in purgatory and he had this guilty conscience.
And for people who don't know, purgatory is that area between heaven and hell.
That's right, yeah, where you're sort of trapped, you're in limbo, and you can't really move on until, you know, some of your sins and mistakes are cleared up and forgiven. And so it may be that he was the one who was taking advantage of this open net, this open invitation, in order to come through and give us the tools that we needed to discover the truth about who he was, his actual sins, and that perhaps he needs that story to be publicized and acknowledged, and he needs to be forgiven so that he can move on. And so we decided to have a second event, which was a blessing. And I invited a number of my great friends to come there who all have experience with blessing and clearing spirits. And we got together with a group of people, and we did a ritual and acknowledged this man and forgave him and told him to pass on. And do you know that since then, George, 90% of the activity at this property has stopped.
Has stopped and gone away.
They still see, from time to time, the figure they believe is Gus Adler, the little old guy who's just wanting to see what happens at the restaurant. But I think a lot of this more disruptive, more visible stuff was O.C. Hamilton trying to get our attention. Now, what we end up here with is a lot of circumstantial evidence, which is about the best you're going to get when it comes to the field of ghost research sometimes.
But at no point did you feel scared or threatened or anything like that?
No, I really didn't, and I'm just fortunate because, as you, of course, were acknowledging, George, when I opened that wide invitation up, something really nasty could have come through.
Right.
But fortunately, I didn't see any evidence that anything bad did come through. But it probably, I don't see why it couldn't have. I just lucked out.
Risky game to play, Josh.
It is. And it also goes to show that these spirits that are not like the imprints I pointed out, that are not like the residuals. These spirits that are actually living, conscious, interactive entities, they have the ability, I believe, to travel, and to not only travel through space, but to travel through time. Because, you know, we have our own very limited egocentric viewpoint of time and how time passes based upon our own living human point of view. It may be that, you know, for some of these figures that we're dealing with, maybe they've been dead 70, 80, 90, 100 years. But to them, maybe they've only been gone for 10 minutes or 2 days. We just don't know exactly how time passes. But what it does tend to indicate is that it's very naive to have this idea that a ghost must stay strictly in one particular spot that it was always attached to or where something dramatic happened, when in fact some of these spirits seem to be able to not only go to a different place in a different time, but can also follow a particular person, can follow a particular object, that you can have portable...
Well, we've known they've followed people. We've known that before.
Yeah. These are portable hauntings. And actually, it's almost like that instead of us looking at this from a three-dimensional point of view, we have to consider that these disembodied consciousnesses are kind of like they're kind of like information that's stored in the grid, and they're able to pop in and out wherever they want to, and you don't necessarily always have to go to a property and comb through its history to look for some type of a major event in order to explain the activity that's happening there. And this throws a lot of investigators off, you know.
How do you get rid of a ghost that might be following you?
That's a great question. And I think what we discovered here with our research at the Byrish House is it gives us an enormous insight into this. There is this concept that has been around in magic and mysticism for thousands of years called true name. And essentially what it means is that if you are being plagued or followed around by some kind of a spiritual entity and you want to address it and you want to tell it to leave you alone, then the first thing you ought to do is try to see if you can figure out who or what it is and literally get its name. It reminds me of the old story of Rumpelstiltskin.
Boy, you go way back on that one.
And, you know, some people say that story, Rumpelstiltskin, goes back like 3,000 or 4,000 years.
Was it Rapunzel?
Well, in this particular, in the Rumpelstiltskin story, you know, there is this young woman who...
Named Rapunzel.
Well, no, that's a different story.
Well, it was?
Rapunzel has the long hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who
else?
Who is the person, though, who kept asking her to let her hair down?
I think that was the Rapunzel story.
Yeah, but who is the person asking for that?
Oh, I don't know that story.
I think it was Rumpelstiltskin. Well, who knows? I'll find out.
But Rumpelstiltskin, in his story, he's a creepy little, you know, spiritual imp, and he is plaguing this woman, and he won't leave her alone unless she can guess his name. And finally, according to the story, one night she creeps up on his little cabin in the woods and hears him singing, and he mentions his own name in the song, and so she figures out his name. The point is, there has been this long tradition that if you can identify the name of this spiritual being that's following you around or tormenting you, that you can control it. And so that's why also you may have seen in some of these movies about exorcism and whatnot, they're always trying to learn the name of the demon. And therefore, in the case of what happened at Byrish House, once we learned the name O.C. Hamilton, that brought us on this, you know, great journey through this whole chain of different bits of information. And this large, elaborate story unfolded, and we were able to properly then address what happened and speak directly to him and tell him to move on. If you've got some entity following you around, then you need to try to learn its name. And you can do that by asking out loud, and maybe on those rare occasions you will literally hear it, or you might be able to record it in an EVP, or you can simply ask for it to show you its name synchronistically so that you might actually see the name appear where you don't expect it, on a piece of paper, on a coin, some way that this name is being expressed to you in the environment. But if you can't get the name, the next best thing is to give it a name. And if you actually name the thing, sometimes that works just as well. And
like a pet or something like that?
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. And that does happen from time to time. You know, somebody says, we have a ghost here. We don't know who the ghost is. We're going to call him Fred. And so there are times when they say, look, Fred, you are not welcome here. Get out of here. And it's by taking this step of sort of representing the spirit with a name that it gives you a handle by which you can sometimes literally control it. And you know what's even stranger, George, is sometimes you can do this with other things that are more abstract. Let's say, for example, you have a pain in your knee.
All right.
And you want that pain to go away, and you're taking medicine, and you're doing everything you can, and you can't get rid of it. Well, try this out. Look at your knee. Imagine that pain as a little character or a little creature or a little entity. Name that creature or that entity, and it doesn't matter if it's a name that makes sense or not. You can just go, and just whatever comes out of your mouth, that's the name. And then you tell, every time your knee starts hurting, you tell that creature, you tell little Beelzebub, get out of there. And you will be amazed how often you can literally take something that is abstract that's happening in your body or around your body, apply a name to it, apply an image to it, and then you can authoritatively boss it around and tell it to leave.
Why does that work?
Well, it may be because that there literally is something magical about the vibration of a sound. And there's a lot of, for example, Jewish mysticism that deals with this, going back to the Kabbalah. And also, you know, the idea of the name of God being a name that you have to use very, very wisely. You know, you don't say that name in vain. But if you do use it, it's a very powerful thing. Even saying the words I am are very powerful because you are representing your own spirit when you say that.
Josh, we're going to hit the break. We're going to come back and take phone calls about hauntings, and I've got a few questions about haunted places as well. All that is next on Coast to Coast AM with Joshua P. Warren.